Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of General Douglas MacArthur, Winston Churchill, Herbert Hoover, General Matt Ridgway, Congressman Joseph Martin, 36 hours in a B-36, and more than 40 men and women in the news in the 20th performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
Although without command authority, I still proudly possess that to me, the greatest of all honors and distinctions, I am an American.
I can only wish, too, that a certain mustachioed gentleman from Moscow might have been with us. Perhaps he might then begin to cut his ambitions down to size.
We'll take off from here, go to New York, to Earlton, Canada, to Point X in Canada. Then we'll proceed to Denver, Mobile Point, for an RBS run on Eglin Field. Then we'll return to Fort Worth. Standard emergency procedures will hold.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for air based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
The first shock of excitement was temporarily over. The last truckloads of confetti and ticker tape had been hauled away. General MacArthur read and rested in his suite at the Waldorf. And for the first time since the recall, radio news programs led with something other than the MacArthur story. And in the nation's newspapers, the expansive 8-column banner headlines were narrowed down to 4, then 3, finally to 1. And even that was moved from the coveted right-hand column spot on the front page as the war, from which he had been recalled, became once again the most important story in the news.
This is an effort to show in a chart the pattern of evaluated vehicular sightings, largely at night, because due to our very effective air operation.
The voice you hear is that of Lieutenant General Matt Ridgway, as he patiently stood before his war maps in Korea and briefed correspondents on communist troop concentrations in the north.
Indicates the number of vehicles it represents, according to the table on the right, and the arrowhead indicates the direction of such traffic as was observed. On the other hand, he is well grouped for offensive action. This concentration could very readily exert a very strong effort down with slight lateral displacement here, down the Chorwan-Sewell axis, down the Kumar-Sewell axis, which is the old invasion corridor.
The communist offensive, which Matt Ridgway had anticipated, came on Sunday, and right down the middle of the old invasion corridor, as he had expected. On Sunday night, an entire new Red Army poured through the mountain gap. Ridgway's 90-mile front was ready for them. For weeks, the long rows of 155s, long toms, had been in position. Their ammunition dumps well stocked, their breaches well oiled. These precision weapons laid down the most concentrated heavy artillery fire of this war. One division commander reported firing 20,000 rounds in 24 hours. The Chinese communists, without air protection or motorized support, continued to pour into the face of this. After 5 days, the army estimated that the North Koreans and the Chinese communists had suffered 37,500 casualties, killed and wounded. We fell back slowly, in order, without panic, heading for an undisclosed line where we would stand and fight the enemy. This was unquestionably the communist big Sunday punch. And if James Van Fleet, who succeeded Ridgway, could hold, it might be his last punch. But even if the enemy is stopped, the Korean War is a long way from being won, and our troops a long way from going home. As General Ridgway put it...
Well, not in the communist timetable, you don't go home. You don't call this thing off. Isn't the end of a big league baseball season? You ring down the curtain when the final ball is caught. It doesn't go that way. The danger with our people, above any other people on Earth, I think, is their impatience, their natural characteristics of impatience.
In Europe, a group of cold, hungry people continue to fight back in the Cold War, where final victory is as important as it is in Korea. Katalin Korady is a Hungarian motion picture star, a capable actress with an unusual singing voice. 6 weeks ago, like most citizens of Budapest, she turned on her radio and heard this.
A Szabad Európa Rádió bemutatja, köszönt a Szabadság című műsorát.
It is the voice of Free Hungary, Radio Free Europe.
This is Radio Free Europe, an independent propaganda weapon started by private citizens and operated by privately subscribed funds. One of Radio Free Europe's most important functions is to tell those behind the Iron Curtain how they can escape. Miss Korady and other Hungarians with a radio and the courage to tune us in hear broadcasts like this one.
It is not difficult to cross the Iron Curtain if you know how. Here is what you must do to get across. When you get to the border zone, 3 miles from the frontier, get off the roads. They are checked. Continue cautiously through the fields or woods till you reach that 500-yard zone just before the barbed wire. Then get on your hands and knees and crawl. If you see the border guard, don't run. Drop flat on your belly. The guard walks a straight route and will pass by. When you come to the barbed wire, feel out for the trip lines connected to the mines. Cut them. Be sure you wear...
Several weeks ago, Katalin Korady crossed the Hungarian border and was welcomed by Allied friends in Vienna. Now, Radio Free Europe has another new star and another new weapon.
Miss Korady got across the border safely. You can too, if you're careful. Here is Katalin Korady to sing for you.
Aprili și Trifona le ciupam, o te noci serelna, o hűséges szívemet talán, meg sem érdemeltem. Könnyű tréfát üsztél csak velem, mással is már megtörtént ilyen. Mosolyogni illenék, de könnyes a két szemem. Áprilisi tréfa volt a csók, mely a szádon éget.
Elsewhere in Europe, the West was having its troubles. Britain signed a new 200,000-ton meat contract with Argentina, but the meat shortage continued, with Mr. Churchill making an occasional joke about the lack of British beef.
I shall always, always use this most useful and agreeable gift which you have made me. Given to me, I'm sure these knives here will, with their perfect quality of steel and workmanship, will suffice to cut up all the meat I am likely to require.
But Mr. Churchill was not the only British politician making jokes about British meat. Another member of Parliament this week was making a lot more news and giving the Attlee government a lot more trouble than Mr. Churchill. His name was Aneurin Bevan.
I'm asked the question here. What do I think about the closing down of two newspapers in Argentina? Now, if I give the answer to that, you wouldn't get any meat.
Aneurin Bevan, usually called Nye, is the socialist counterpart to Winston Churchill. A 53-year-old Welshman, dynamic, a colorful orator, his political views are diametrically opposed to Mr. Churchill's and substantially to the left of Prime Minister Attlee's. This week, Nye Bevan rebelled against what he called Britain's overemphasis in arming at the expense of social service gains. He said, "We have allowed ourselves to be dragged too far behind the wheels of American diplomacy." With those words, the man who expects to become a future socialist prime minister left the cabinet, whose grasp of power is held by the slimmest of margins. With Mr. Churchill's conservatives once again asking for a general election, Mr. Bevin's departure from the cabinet may prove to be the very straw which could break Labour's weakening back and return to office the Tories, whom Nye Bevin hates so much, and of whom he recently said,
"I've been looking at the people that Mr. Churchill is anxious to get back into power. I was looking at them all these years, all the people who are supposed to be the natural leaders of Great Britain. And I am bound to tell you, quite frankly, that every time I look at them, I get a sense of superiority."
Despite Bevin's resignation and that of Harold Wilson, president of the Board of Trade, the Labour government clung to its narrow majority and continued to govern. Herbert Morrison, the new foreign secretary, said that if it came to a choice between the rearmament program and the standard of living, then the standard of living would have to come down. Nye Bevin was the first man of stature in Britain to try to capture and lead the anti-American sentiment of his country. He agreed with some of Mr. Attlee's policies, but not all. But in this nation, facing one of its most trying periods, and about to make decisions as important as any we have ever had to face, talk of unity was scarce, and invective and accusations ran heavy, with the words traitor, appeaser, fascist, and warmongers appearing more and more in the Washington vocabulary. General MacArthur himself was dwarfed by the debate which raged over him and the policies that caused his recall. On Saturday, the New York Times, under the byline of their White House correspondent, Anthony Laviro, ran an article which stated that the Pentagon had files to prove that MacArthur had been wrong about Chinese intervention in Korea. Mr. Laviro reads part of that article.
Washington, April 20th. Today, the New York Times gained access to documented sources on the meeting of President Truman, the Commander-in-Chief, and the United Nations Commander on the Mid-Pacific Atoll. 6 months ago on Wake Island, General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, according to administration records made at the time, expressed doubt that Red China would intervene in Korea and offered his best troops, the United States 2nd Division, for service in Europe.
MacArthur's aide, General Courtney Whitney, claimed that no notes had been taken at the Wake meeting, that much of the time Truman and MacArthur were alone. Many Republicans, including Senator Richard Nixon of California, whom you hear now, claimed that the White House and the Pentagon were getting ready to smear MacArthur.
The American people should know that as the hearings begin into our Far Eastern policy, a whole staff of Pentagon and State Department officials have been ordered to comb the record of General MacArthur for the purpose, if possible, of destroying his past reputation. The tactics used is to disclose that portion of General MacArthur's record which would damage his reputation and to withhold that portion which would be in his favor.
In the Senate, where tempers and insults are becoming as much a part of the tradition as the gavel in the cloakroom, both sides lined up to call each other names, and the nation sat and listened with more concern than amusement. You are about to hear sections of a recent debate between the Democratic senator from Oklahoma, Robert Kerr, and the Republican senator from Maine, Owen Brewster. The first voice you hear is that of Senator Kerr.
I know that Red Russia is trying to maneuver China into trapping or inciting or enticing us into an all-out war with China. But, Mr. President, in their wildest moments of fiendish hope, Red Russia never expected a great military commander from America to openly promote their goals. Out of the shouting and tumult of this debate, the fact that emerges bold and clear is that the Democratic Party continues to be the peace party, while many Republican leaders have succeeded in showing that their party is the war party.
Republican Senator Brewster of Maine rose to answer this.
Is the senator from Oklahoma aware of the fact that three times in our generation, this nation has become involved in war, and that at the time the government had been under the control of Democratic administrations, in the first instance for 5 years, in the second instance for 9 years, and in this instance for 4 years?
Then Senator Kerr began getting a little rough about the Republicans.
They wouldn't know a policy if they met one in the middle of the road. They wouldn't have a policy if they knew one. They haven't had a policy since Cal Coolidge solemnly announced that he was against sin. Sometimes it seems that they are just in one whirling, roaring whirry-go-round. I wonder if they have forgotten the prophetic song, the title of which could be paraphrased to read, "The Whirry-Go-Round Broke Down."
Then it was Senator Whirry's turn to go round.
Mr. President, I am not at all worried about the power to run the whirry-go-round, as labeled by the senator from Oklahoma. With the winds coming from Oklahoma as they have come this afternoon, we have endless power to keep it going round and round and round. It was just a big wind blowing from Oklahoma, and there's no wind that blows like an Oklahoma wind.
The senator from Oklahoma again.
As to the senator's remark about the big wind from Oklahoma, I warn him, either keep in touch with it or get blown away by it.
But this illuminating exchange between three statesmen was just a bland preliminary to the major exchange of the week. This one occurred not on the floor of the August Senate, but in the basement, in a radio recording studio. Senator Homer Capehart of Indiana, Republican, and Democrats Herbert Lehman of New York and Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota swapped blows, which, according to some witnesses, were not all verbal. Senator Taft was there, too. Here, in the public interest, is a brief portion of the exciting, if indecisive, final round. First, Senator Humphrey.
And I'm amazed to see men of the United States Senate who were worried about precipitating action in Europe by sending four divisions to our allies in Europe, worried that we might irritate the Russians, who are willing to stick their head into the trap that the bear, the Russian bear, is setting in the Chinese area by committing American troops, too few troops, if you please, we already have too few troops in Korea, into a major attack upon the Chinese mainland, precipitating
the war. That's a complete misrepresentation by Senator Humphrey of what's proposed. We do not propose the invasion of China by a single American troop. Not one.
Don't you call
aviator?
Wait a minute.
Senator Lehman first.
Senator, yield a moment.
No.
Just a minute.
I want to say that Senator Capehart has spilled the beans. He's perfectly frankly for a declaration of war on China, which would mean an all-out
world
war.
Now, Senator, that isn't
Senator
true,
Capehart,
and you know it isn't
true. Said that same thing 3 months ago on China.
You know I said nothing of the sort, and you know I'm
right
not...
here in front of
wait
me.
A minute.
Want me
now,
to
wait,
read
you
it?
Know I'm not for declaring war. Let me tell you what I did say. That was that any time any nation's troops kill American boys, I'm for going and getting them and killing them, and I stand on it, and I say to you that anybody or any nation that are sympathetic with the communist China today, and I take it from your debate here today, you and Senator Humphrey, that you are...
That is absolutely vilification.
Because you're not for going over there and fighting them. You're even keeping the nationalist government from fighting them. That you're not opposed to the communist government in China... And I say to you, you're not fundamentally opposed to us.
Well, all I can say is that Senator from Indiana is a prevaricator and deliberately indulging in falsehood and character assassination. This is an outrage.
I say to you, it's
Senator
true,
Lehman.
And I stand by it.
May I
Senator
say
Lehman.
To you, Senator Capehart, that's a libelous statement.
It's no more libelous than what you said a moment ago about me.
It's a libelous statement. I've
not
been
libelous,
communism.
And I stand on it, and I'll continue to stand on it.
I fought communism before you ever
it,
were heard of.
With
now
me.
I'm going to read.
Let's keep your blood pressure down, you'll get the answer.
Your statement is absolutely libelous. I fought more strenuously and vehemently against communism than you ever thought.
Sorry, our time is up, and our thanks tonight go to Senators Capehart of Indiana, Lehman of New York, Taft of Ohio, and Humphrey of Minnesota. This is Blair Moody signing off now in Washington.
2 days later, the moderator, the man in the middle of this program, Blair Moody of the Detroit News, was summoned by Governor Williams of Michigan and appointed to fill the unexpired term of the late Senator Arthur Vandenberg, who died last week. Here, Senator Moody explains why Williams appointed him.
He said, you've been down there for 18 years, Blair, and he said, you've had a chance to learn where the back door of the cloakroom is. He said, I think that we want to have someone down there that can get in and do what he can right away.
In another cloakroom, Capitol cloakroom, a CBS forum broadcast, Congressman Joe Martin, whose letter to General MacArthur set in motion the chain of events that led to the MacArthur dismissal, said he was not so sure of General Eisenhower as he was of General MacArthur.
Representative Martin, would you send more than four troops to Europe?
That depends on conditions. You can't. No one can make a flat statement as how many you do, because that would depend entirely on conditions. But I'd first get somebody over in Europe that organize them so that we know that we had someone to help us.
Well, how about General Eisenhower? Isn't he doing the job?
I would not know that. Because all we know, that's the one thing that I fear from the MacArthur incident more than anything else. As the rules have been set up by the President and the War Department, us members of Congress, we don't know whether he's just echoing the voice of the President or whether he's telling us the actual facts. That's where I think that's a terrific mistake to stop a high general from giving his views on what he thinks is best for the country.
Well, that would apply to the Joint Chiefs of Staff also, then. In other words, they are going to be suspect whenever they come before...
Whenever they come before Congress or any bureaucrat, no matter the smallest bureaucrat comes before Congress, there's a rule that he can't say a word that the White House doesn't want without he's liable to be dismissed.
And General MacArthur hasn't been so muzzled.
General MacArthur's one man in a million.
This program could not learn what General Eisenhower's reactions were to this remark, nor could we learn how such talk affected the general's enormous task in molding Western Europe into an effective fighting force. Senator Brian McMahon, chairman of the Senate Atomic Energy Committee, in weighing the respective importance of Europe and Asia, said this.
Mr. President, there are four fundamental strategic facts which passion may obscure, but which we will ignore at our peril. Fact number one is American unpreparedness for all-out war, except, and this is a very important exception, in the field of atomic energy. We have not nearly mobilized the air fleets and the naval forces and the ground troops that we would like to possess for major conflict. Fact number two is the industrial war potential of Western Europe. The munitions plants and factories that have no remote counterpart in Asia. I challenge any senator to contradict my statement that Russia and Western Europe, if ever merged together under communist rule, could in time produce more atomic bombs and more long-range bombers and more armaments of all kinds than could the United States. Here is the basic reason why Europe takes priority over Asia. Lose Europe and you lose the arms race.
The byproducts of the MacArthur return were many. MacArthur pipes were being sold by the thousands. A children's braided MacArthur hat was already in production. The major record companies were flying copies of his congressional speech to record shops throughout the country. And Tin Pan Alley was getting into the act, too. Since General MacArthur's return, songwriters have frantically tried and song publishers have eagerly sought to put into words and music the MacArthur mood. This is the effort of Marion Black of Washington.
Hi there, Mac, and a pat on the back for the grand job that you've always done. So here's the key to the land you kept free. Today, you're America's favorite son.
Another contribution from Richmond, Virginia.
From the Philippines to Tokyo, I was the toast of the town. They came from Osa, they answered no, sir, and I was told to step down. I got the five-star general blue.
And Bing Crosby was in there, too.
Soldiers never die, never die, never die. Oh, soldiers never die. They simply fade away.
As for General MacArthur, he remained in seclusion in the Waldorf. paying a brief courtesy call on ex-President Hoover, receiving personal visits from Cardinal Spellman, Senator Taft, and publishers Henry Luce, Roy Howard, Colonel McCormick, and William R. Hearst, Jr. General Whitney talked to the working press for him. Every day, Whitney went down to visit with the press and answered some questions for them. General Whitney, when asked if the general was reading the millions of lines of copy about himself.
He hasn't listened to the radio, and he hasn't read the newspapers. Only insofar as the official communique from Korea are concerned. The war situation in Korea is, of course, his primary concern.
Was the general getting ready to write his memoirs?
General MacArthur has had a number of offers for his memoirs. I don't recall the details of them. He has consistently taken the view that he's still too young.
Last night in Chicago, General MacArthur stood before a huge crowd in Chicago's Soldier Field.
Just as a memento of this, your day in Chicago, I hand to you this documentary record of Chicago's tribute to you, General MacArthur.
He told them he was greatly encouraged to find that the American people unhesitatingly voiced their views on the direction of the policy of government. And then the general said this.
It is for future events to ascertain whether they still retain the ultimate authority over government as intended by the Constitution, or whether such authority has been lost in the drift from the pattern ordained by the architects of our political institutions.
General MacArthur paid tribute to our troops in Korea. Asked again, what is our policy in Korea? He surveyed the various answers. Stalemate, clear South Korea, continued attrition. But he said,
none of these will tell you in the traditionally ringing tones of the American patriot that our objective is victory over the nation and men who, without provocation or justification, have warred against us. And that our... And that our forces will be furnished all the sinews and other means essential to achieve that victory with a minimum of cost in human life.
That was the general's most blunt, direct call for war to victory against China. He spoke of nations with only token forces in Korea, of undue and exaggerated political pressures from abroad, said he would continue to urge a realistic policy for Korea, continue to fight against communism. The general made one statement which drew vigorous dissent from his audience. Listen.
Although my public life is now closed, and I no longer... responsibilities of the national administration, I feel my responsibility of national citizenship no less deeply. Although without command authority or responsibility, I still proudly possess that to me the greatest of all honors and distinctions. I am an American.
General Douglas MacArthur has been called many things since coming home. Vocabularies on both sides have been strained. But it remained for our only living former president, Mr. Herbert Hoover, speaking to newspaper publishers here in New York last night, to announce the general's reincarnation.
Now the great debate is replaced by a bigger debate. It is led by a reincarnation of St. Paul into a great
soldier of the armies, a great general of the armies, who has come out of the East. Now Uncle Joe should get no satisfaction from our practices of free speech in these debates. He only needs to recollect how Kaiser Wilhelm and Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo mistook our family discussions, and he would observe that this republic has a fashion of closing ranks at the appropriate moment with a solidarity and a punch that is final.
The MacArthurs were in Milwaukee today and would be in Murfreesboro, Tennessee for their anniversary. And the general would be in Washington next week for the Senate hearings on the Korean controversy. We may then get some real evidence upon which opinion can be based. Many editors and commentators had exhausted their adjectives, but some of the hysteria and blind partisanship had evaporated. There were instances where citizens were known to disagree with MacArthur or with the administration's policy without being accused of treason. Until more evidence is in, all that can be said has already been said several times. Some editors blew their tops, others remained steady. In the course of our unscientific survey of the press, we encountered the Dahlonega Nugget, the gold of the news, a weekly paper published in Dahlonega, Georgia. The Bloodmobile will be there Wednesday. A byline piece by Mary Abercrombie informs us that a whippoorwill was heard at Upper Wahoo Sunday night. But we were interested in editorial comment. Editor Jack Parks of the Dahlonega Nugget led his column with these words.
We had planned to write a thunderous editorial this week on the firing of General MacArthur, but we regret to report that news from Yahula and Frogtown, plus other disturbances in and around Dahlonega, have crowded the general off the front page of the Nugget. If anyone is interested in getting our views on the MacArthur issue, they may secure the same by calling on us at our offices in the Nugget Tower.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is Program 20 on Hear It Now, a full-hour review of the week's news, told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow. There was a once familiar sound, not often heard in recent years, in the news this week. The Mississippi was overflowing its banks again, in one of the worst floods in many years.
We're traveling down the Mississippi today, scene of the greatest flood since the 1880s. The great and awful damage caused by this river is very clear. We're over Dubuque, Iowa, where the river crested this morning at 22 and 74 hundredths feet. Water's creeping in on the streets and the railroad tracks. Streets going along in orderly fashion, as streets should. Then suddenly they vanish beneath the shallow, flooding waters of the Mississippi.
Your reporter is Dick Cheverton of station WMT, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, as he ranged over the swollen river in his special plane. This report was made on Monday. Since then, the crest of the river has risen, but amazingly, there have been almost no deaths from the flood. The plane, as it nears Cibola.
Below us, a pair of bright green barges and a towboat are nested along the shore, riding out the flood. Floodgates are up on the government dams. There's no attempt to hold back the water. Downriver, as we approach Cibola, it's almost too small to see. Cibola today, little battleship island, completely surrounded by water.
Altogether, more than 7,400 went homeless, with some 24,000 persons prepared to evacuate if the rains continue.
At Savannah, across the river, five grain elevators have wet feet. The railroad snakes across this river, its roadbed under. The tracks, double line of contact with drier civilization. Farther down the river, here at Davenport, the municipal stadium is wet. Along the first baseline, the field ends and the river begins. The oil storage tanks are like marshmallows floating on a thick, gummy chocolate syrup. Water's lapping at the threshold of the lend-a-hand. The ferry landing is no more.
The Mississippi is on its annual rampage. Spring 1951. Still unchecked by all the great engineering strides in flood control. But as of tonight, the rains have stopped. The waters, though not receding, are no higher. The worst seems over. War mobilizer Charles E. Wilson returned from an extensive inspection of the nation's production centers, including Wright Field at Dayton, Ohio. Mr. Wilson will leave shortly for conferences with General Eisenhower in Paris. He spoke last night to the newspaper publishers' convention in New York. Mr. Wilson.
I can only wish that you had been with me to share with me the warm glow of pride I felt in our American genius of design, development, and production. I can only wish, too, that a certain mustachioed gentleman from Moscow might have been with us. Perhaps he might then begin to cut his ambitions down to size. Since the first of this year, orders have been placed at the rate of $1 billion a week and more. The end of 1953, we will be able to meet the demands of all-out war, if need be, and God forbid, out of our production lines. Then, if any aggressor wants to tangle with us, he would have to be crazy.
One of America's mighty war weapons is already on hand, the B-36 heavy bomber, the plane that the Air Force calls the fastest, longest-ranging, highest-flying, greatest carrier of the greatest quantity of high explosives of any airplane in the world today. The B-36 is a controversial aircraft. The Congress has devoted many hours to hearing arguments by its friends and domestic enemies. But it's the biggest thing of its type we have. For the next few minutes of this program, we will take you on a B-36 flight from Carswell Air Force Base in Texas, thousands of miles around this country in Canada, and back to Carswell. It's a training mission, the type that hundreds of these planes carry out, unknown to most of us. The Strategic Air Command calls it a simulated mission, and we will simulate a mission for you tonight. In 20 minutes, we will take you on a 36-hour flight. The air rules for this flight are simple. Strategic Air Command permits no civilians in its B-36. But we were permitted to place our recorder in the plane. Now, to Carswell Air Force Base, 20 minutes from downtown Fort Worth in Texas.
This is a general briefing by the 7th Bomb Wing, directing that the 436 Bomb Squadron crew fly simulated high-altitude mission on target at Eglin Field, Florida. Takeoff time will be 0700, climbing en route to 10,000 feet.
You are listening to a briefing of pilots of the 8th Air Force, 7th Bomb Wing. Its mission is to organize and train a force capable of immediate and sustained long-range offensive operations in any part of the world. The order has come from Strategic Air Command headquarters for a special mission. It was transmitted to Carswell by teletype. After the pilots have been briefed, there will be special briefings on communications, weather, and then, on the ramp near the runway, the aircraft commander will call his crew together and explain it again.
Okay, let's gather around for this briefing. We'll take off from here, go to New York, to Earlton, Canada, to Point X in Canada. Then we'll proceed to Denver, Mobile Point, for an RBS run on Eglin Field. Then we'll return to Fort Worth. We'll climb out here to 10,000 feet, and for the first portion of the flight, we'll be at 35,000 feet over Eglin. Standard emergency procedures will hold. There'll be three short rings on the alarm bell to alert you, one long ring, and a verbal command for execution. There'll be six short rings for a crash landing with one long ring just before impact. Does anyone have any questions?
The crew of this 436 heavy bomber squadron plane now knows its target for 36 hours later. 16 men climb into the plane, the aircraft commander and the pilot and the co-pilot. Each man can and does fly the plane. There are two flight engineers, two radio operators, five gunners, who are also called scanners, because when not in combat, they scan the engines for oil leaks, loose cowlings, and flap positions. We also have four observers, each qualified to work radar, navigate, or handle the bomb site. The crewmen are now settled in their positions. The ground crew has completed its endless checking and testing. Ground power generators are on, and we're ready to start the motors. And the ground crew chief takes over.
Sergeant Rock, will you get the headset? So, Mike. Sergeant Null, you and BFC Philby get the fire extinguisher. Sergeant Wellens, you get the left wing, and I'll get the right wing. Watch the engine whenever it starts. Notify the pilot or flight engineer when anything happens.
Inside and outside your B-36, checks are continuing. More than 600 items in all will have to be checked before takeoff. And when the technical details on this $3.5 million aircraft are all set, and the aircraft commander talks to his crew, there are more than 27 miles of wire in this airplane, much of it used for communications from the pilot up front through every crew member to the rear gunner, 130 feet back. The clicks you will hear come from the intercom system. Everyone wears a throat mic, two black buttons strapped to his throat. When you press the button, you're talking to everyone in the plane. Now the pilot checks the alarm bell, the phone system, the oxygen equipment of his crewmen.
Pilot to crew, give me alarm bell, oxygen interphone check, please.
Navigator's interphone, alarm bell, okay, oxygen, 400 pounds.
Radar, alarm bell, interphone, okay, oxygen, 400 pounds.
Compound, alarm bell, and interphone, okay, oxygen, 400 pounds.
Engineer, alarm bell, interphone, okay, oxygen, 400 pounds.
Radio, interphone.
You have 10 engines on your plane, 6 reciprocating piston-type engines, and 4 jets. They give you 42,000 horsepower, the equivalent of 9 locomotives pulling streamlined trains at top speed. As much power as 400 average passenger automobiles can generate. But you don't just flick a switch and take off. It takes time, and there's endless checking to be done.
Roger. Stand by for engine start. Engineer, you ready to start engines?
Right, sir. Checklist complete. Ready to start engines.
Okay, pilot checklist complete. Brakes are set. You're clear to start.
Now the emergency switch on. Brakes on. Process normal.
Roger.
Engineer to ground. Over.
Go ahead.
All air plugs, intercoolers open.
Roger.
All the props clear?
Props clear.
Okay, starting number 4.
Roger's all clear.
We're starting it now.
Roger, number 4, drive. Swift. Running. Firing.
This is the power of the plane that can fly 10,000 miles and drop 10,000 pounds of bomb halfway and reach an altitude of 45,000 feet, 8.5 miles in the air.
Roger. Number 6 clear.
Roger. It's all clear.
Okay, starting 6.
Running dry.
You're almost ready to go now, but you need a check from the tower, instructions. And you'll need your 4 jets to help you take off, and later to give you additional speed.
Co-pilot, would you check flight controls while I contact tower for taxi instructions? Carswell Tower, this 2658, over.
Air Force 2658, Carswell Tower.
Tower 2658, request taxi takeoff instructions, please.
2658 Carswell Tower, advise traffic north on 35 left, altimeter setting 2977. Surface winds are northeast at 6. Clear to taxi, Ellie.
Roger, thank you. 2658. Pilot crew, stand by to taxi. Engineer, you ready to taxi?
Roger, ready to taxi.
Scanners, we have fire truck back of us now.
Roger, sir, we have fire truck.
Okay, Fred, you can start jet engine J1.
Roger, starting J1.
When all 4 of your jets are stabilized, you pull up on the long runway, 1.5 miles long, 100 yards wide. Halfway down that runway, our microphone is open, ready to record the sound of your 10 engines as you pull up to it, pass it, and get off the ground to start a practice mission of thousands of miles. A mission that will keep you in the air for 36 hours. Your 42,000 horsepower is pushing you into the air. Your plane weighs 358,000 pounds. From wingtip to wingtip, she measures 230 feet. That's longer than the distance covered by the Wright brothers' first airplane flight. And inside her bomb bay, when the time comes for her to fly in anger, she can carry more than 5 tons of explosives or the atomic bomb and reach a top speed of over 400 miles an hour. Your B-36 is airborne now. Carswell Air Base and our microphones are far behind on the runway. Now we go back to the airplane and the crew.
Okay, we'll climb up here to about 10,000 for the first leg and level off there. Radar pilot. There's radar, go ahead. How's the set looking? Oh, it's looking pretty good, Chris. Looks pretty good. Looks like we might make some money today.
In a few hours, you're over Indiana at cruising speed.
Left scanner, this pilot.
Go ahead, sir.
Didn't you tell me once your home was in Evansville?
Roger, sir.
We'll be coming up there in about 5 minutes. The weather looks pretty good. You might be able to see it.
Roger, sir.
I heard that was a good place to be from.
Yeah, from.
Time passes slowly on these training missions. There are 6 bunks in the rear of the plane when your time comes to go off duty. Otherwise, you sit and watch and talk and think and keep remembering that down below, Strategic Air Command is watching your every move. Before you get back to Carswell, you will have flown over many millions of sleeping Americans who don't know you're up there. You're making a grand sky tour of thousands of cities you'll never see from the ground. You break into your box lunch and your liquid lunch. You use the plane's heaters. You get cold and warm, hungry and thirsty, tired and alert. One city after another passes below you. American cities on these practice missions. And then, some 4 hours from your home base, you're over America's biggest city.
I'll never get on the radar, over.
That's radar. Go ahead.
Bob, we're coming to the New York area. We're about 25 miles southwest. See if you can get me a range and bearing on Staten Island, will you?
Roger, sure will. Engineer, Mr. Scanner.
Go ahead.
Got some more heat back here.
Hi, Roger. Coming up.
Boy, that old island sure looks good down here through this radar set. Yeah, I wish I was down there taking in some of that nightlife. What would you be doing down there? Some of the people have all the fun.
Them joints stayed open till 4 o'clock in the morning. That way you can see your kids in the daylight.
Closest we can get to New York City is 10,000 feet.
Yeah, so near yet so far.
You're riding smoothly now, and everything is checked and rechecked. No worry about the gas. You're carrying more than 21,000 gallons of it. That's enough to drive your car around the world 16 times and then make a grand tour of the States. You have 1,200 gallons of oil. You're surrounded by enough aluminum to make at least 50,000 pots and pans. You're not carrying a bomb on this simulated mission, and so your vast bomb bay is empty. But you could get up to 84,000 pounds into her. A cargo version of the big B-36 could carry up to 400 troops, and you could carry the equivalent of 26 automobiles. You've been in the air for more than 5 hours now, and down below is Nova Scotia. And some of your crew feel sorry for the little people on the ground.
Pilot to crew, we're about 50 miles south of the border, and this country gets pretty rough up there, so you better put your emergency equipment on and get set for an emergency which might arise. Radio, would you pass me up a lunch plate?
Roger, sir.
Radar pilot? Go ahead. Say, I wonder if we'll see any of that Aurora Borealis up here again tonight. It might. It sure was pretty the last time we were up here. It's quite a display. Yeah, I guess the people down the ground sure would like to see it from way up here where we are. It looks like we'll be maybe just about 3 miles east of Earlton itself. Hey, Mac, you want a cup of tea?
Roger. Pass it right up. I'm ready.
Left scanner, this pilot.
Go ahead, sir.
Did the guns check out okay?
Roger, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Your pilot asks for a gun check, because if and when the time comes for you to fight and bomb the enemy, you'll need to protect yourself. You have 16 20-millimeter cannons, 8 in turrets that are remotely controlled. All of the turrets, except the one in the nose and one in the rear, are retractable. You have more firepower than any other known bomber. You're moving along now and approaching what the Strategic Air Command prefers to call Point X. We have no desire to pinpoint it for any enemy. We're about 12 hours from Carswell now, at the end of one phase of this training mission. And you still have a long way to go.
Navigator, pilot.
Go ahead, Chris.
What's our position now?
We're about 25 miles southeast of that northernmost Point X. We should make our turn back down in about 7 minutes. I'll give you a call, and you can bring your heading around about 195.
Okay, about 7 minutes.
Back to the United States, and you head for Denver, another checkpoint on your long flight. Denver comes and goes, and you're approaching the business at hand. You climb upstairs. as if to avoid enemy interceptors and radar. You start using your jets again, and your aircraft commander makes yet another check.
Now, navigator to 2, you're going to call the United States boundary in 10 minutes.
Roger. Thank you, Art. How's the gas checking out, Mac?
We're down okay, sir. We've got plenty.
We're now at 35,000 feet. Give me an oxygen check, please.
Navigator's oxygen equipment okay.
Radar, oxygen okay.
Co-pilot, oxygen equipment's okay. Engineer, oxygen equipment's okay.
Now is the time your $3.5 million plane must prove itself. Now is the time the 16 members in the crew must prove themselves. The intercom buzzes with orders and checks. You don't worry about what the Navy thinks of your airplane or what the Army thinks of strategic bombing. You worry about Strategic Air Command, what your superiors will think of your efficiency and performance. You contact your target area. They're watching you by radar, and they'll check you carefully when you drop your simulated bomb. You're coming close to the IP, the initial point. Your speed nears maximum. From there, you take a bearing on your target for today. Then your pilot will turn the B-36 over to the radar bombardier through the automatic pilot. 2658 is getting down to business.
Navigator, the radar.
His radar, go ahead.
How's your picture, boy?
You're all set up. I got everything in the computer. We're all set to go. Radar to pilot.
Go ahead, radar.
Question is, you get over the IP, you can go ahead and center the steering needle, and I'll take over from there.
Okay.
Navigator to pilot.
Go ahead, navigator.
You're 30 seconds off the IP.
Okay, I'm turning over the IP now, and centering the steering needle.
Okay, boy, here we go. She's looking good, boy. We got to nail this one today.
Radar, the airspeed is all squared away up here. It's looking pretty good.
Yes, it looks good down here. Picture looks good, and we're right on the target.
Agnum bomb plot from Air Force 2658. We are 3-0 miles from target.
Roger, 2658, this is Eglin Bomb Plot. We have you in contact now. You need to make no further calls, over.
Roger, 2658. We will turn the tone control on approximately 15 seconds before bomb is away.
Roger, we're standing by on your tone.
Roger, all right, we're going over to tone now.
Bombs away, 2658.
You start losing altitude now and wait eagerly for the bomb scoring unit at Eglin Field in Florida, your simulated target, to tell you how well you've done. If you've hit the button, they'll tell you. And if you've missed, they'll tell you by how much, all in code.
Radar pilot.
Go ahead, radar.
She looked good down here. How'd she look up there?
Everything was on the money up here, Bob. It ought to be a pretty good run. Crew, this pilot, we are now at 25,000 feet. You may remove your mask and helmet.
Air Force 2658, this is Eglin Bomb Plot, over.
Go ahead, Bomb Plot, this is 2658.
2658, your score on that run was a King Victor 0-0, over.
Woohoo! Dog. Roger, Eglin Bomb Plot, this is 2658. Thank you very much and good day.
But it would have been a bad day for any enemy who caused our high command to set loose the Strategic Air Command. There's still the matter of getting home. You've been in the air 33 hours now, long enough to fly you over many European and Asiatic capitals, and you've only got some 700 miles to go back to where you came from. You're still careful with your big plane and her invaluable crew. You approach Carswell Air Force Base and contact GCA. That's Ground Control Approach. They'll help you come down as if you were flying blind in foul weather, landing at a strange base.
Navigator, pilot.
Go ahead, pilot.
How far out of Fort Worth are we now?
You're about 18 miles southeast.
Okay, I'll contact your tower.
Okay.
Carswell Tower, this is Air Force 2658. We request a GCA to Carswell, over.
Roger, Air Force 2658, this is Carswell GCA. The weather at Carswell is as following. Visibility 4 miles, ceiling is 700 feet. Altimeter setting 29 or 85, 29 or 85. The wind is from the south. David, we have a light rain here at Carswell. What is pilot's name, type aircraft, and home station, over.
Roger, GCA. This is 2658. The pilot's name is Cresilius. I spell Charlie, Roger, Easy, Charlie, Easy, Love, Ida, Uncle, Sugar. Rank Major, 436 Squadron, home base, Carswell, and B-36 type aircraft.
Air Force 2658, this is Carswell GCA. The runway at Carswell is 8,200 feet long, 300 feet wide, negative shoulders, over.
Roger.
Roger, 2658, this is Carswell GCA, final controller. You need not acknowledge further transmission. Set your gyro with your magnetic compass. Do not reset for the remainder of this run. You are now coming up on glide path, looking very good, 600 feet per minute. 600 feet per minute is your rate of descent, looking very good. 600 feet is your rate of descent, looking very good at this time. Bring it down, increase your rate of descent. Now on glide path and holding, looking very good. Correcting very nicely to on course. Now on course, looking good at this time. Make your final landing gear check. Check your wheels down and lock. 174 is your heading. You are now approaching Carswell GCA minimums at this time. Wish to advise again that we have rain on the runway. Now approaching end of runway, on course, on glide path. Now over end of runway, take over visually. Over.
That microphone you left 36 hours ago is again opened along the long runway to record you as you come down. Are reversed. And when you're safely back on the ground, your pilot pays his respects to GCA.
GCA, this is 2658. Thank you very much. That was a good run.
And back in his office, General Clarence T. Irvine, commanding general, 19th Air Division, sums it up for you. This flight and the many others about which you know nothing.
The B-36s and the men that fly and the men that support them have proved themselves time and again. They are ready and able to deal the most devastating blow in history to any enemy anywhere in the world. All they await is their call to action.
Big bombers are useful weapons, but there must be a place to park and refuel them. That means bases overseas. In time of war, we could fly the heavy stuff only from countries that were also at war with Russia. The getting and keeping of those bases is not only a military problem. It's a political and diplomatic one, too. It is possible to imagine circumstances where we might have to fight a war alone. In that event, we must be able to reach out and strike from this continent. That's the reason the Air Force has ordered, practically off the drawing board, the big B-52, which will have the legs and carry the load. But it hasn't yet been built or flown. And today's battles cannot be fought with tomorrow's or next year's weapons. That's why those bases, the B-36s, and allies remain so important in our grand strategy of the air.
This is a general briefing by the 7th Bomb Wing, directing that the 436 Bomb Squadron fly simulated high-altitude mission on target at Eglin Field, Florida. Takeoff time will be 0700, climbing en route to 10,000 feet, direct for New York City, thence to the turning point of Earlton, Kennedy.
You have just heard Program 20 in the CBS series Hear It Now, a document for ear based on the week's news. Hear It Now is edited and produced by Edward R. Murrow and Fred W. Friendly, and a CBS staff which includes Edmund Scott, Jesse Zausmer, Irving Gitlin, John Aaron, and Joseph Wershberg. Portions of the program originated at WTOP, Washington, WTAG, Worcester, KRLD, Dallas, WMT, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, WAGA, Atlanta, WRVA, Richmond, WIOU, Kokomo, Indiana, and KNX, Los Angeles. Special acknowledgement is made to the Strategic Air Command and the 8th Air Force for making the B-36 story possible, and to Colonel Everett A. Best, Major Robert Keim, and Lieutenant Hal Harlan for their technical assistance, along with all the crew members of plane number 076. This is Olin Tice speaking.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.